We're still trying to figure out whether we can make it work again for this year, but as many of you already know, my wife Tevis and I have enjoyed some time in the south of France over the last few summers. And it's really been neat finding ourselves immersed in a different culture. And we've enjoyed all sorts of discoveries as we've journeyed about, and also just enjoyed watching the world go by as we relax. Last summer, we actually ventured out of Provence, which is where we've been staying, and we headed west into the Languedoc region, and it was most delightful. We visited the old walled city of Carcassonne, which was okay. Because I found it a bit more commercialized than I'd hoped for. It had kind of like that medieval Disney feel to it. I mean, your mileage may vary. It just didn't quite work for us. So my Phil Steves recommendation is spend some time in Narbonne instead. It's close and it's quite lovely. Anyway, quickly realizing that we'd seen what we needed to see after 2 hours in Carcassonne, Tevis and I decided to explore the general area, and we drove north on this really windy road, went up about a dozen miles, and we ended up at a place called La Tour. And to our surprise, we discovered there something called Chateau de La Tour, which are the remains of four Cathar castles that are located on the tops of the nearby mountains. Despite the 35 degree centigrade plus heat, we hiked to each of the castles, again proving the song about mad dogs and Englishmen and midday sun and all that. But, you know, the trip, it was really worth it. We had fantastic views, and we picked up all sorts of history. I encourage you, look up the Cathars. They're a fascinating group of individuals. And anyway, this was really fascinating because, frankly, we didn't really have much clue about this area before we sort of arrived there. None of this was on our original itinerary. It was quite unexpected. On the other hand, when we got back to Aubagne in Provence, we went out on a day trip with our friends, and we left with a very clear plan in mind. We had decided on an excursion up Mont Ventoux, highest mountain in the Vaucluse area in the northern part of Provence, and Mont Ventoux just dominates the landscape. As the name suggests, Ventoux, meaning windy in French, is a blustery, rugged place. At the summit, it looks a bit like the moon. It's a regular segment on the Tour de France, which, of course, is, as you might guess, one of the reasons I find it especially interesting. I admit I conjure up all sorts of scenes in my mind, you know, Phil claiming the polka dot on white jersey, named King of the Mountains after some heroic sprint up the legendary Mont Ventoux. A boy can dream, can't he? Now, Tev and I had actually been there the year before. But our friend said that we really needed to go back because there was a little eating establishment that shouldn't be missed. So we had a glorious trip that day together. We stopped at some wineries on the way. I bought a new cycling jersey, coincidentally. We made some wrong turns, normal for me, even with the GPS. And yes, we took some pictures on the top on what was an uncharacteristically non-windy day. The weather was absolutely perfect. Then we went a few kilometers down the mountain and stopped at what looked like a very busy coffee, beer, and baguette joint. And it was next to a seasonally quiet ski tow operation. If you could mentally put goats on the roof, you can imagine what this place looks like, okay? That's what it looked like. So we got out of the car, walked to a virtually hidden set of stairs over by the tow line, and we climbed up and behind the coffee shop. And we found a rather modest but nice-looking restaurant that, as best I can remember, lacked any signage. In we went, and I had one of the finest meals of my life. I mean, afterwards, I was emailing Diane. I was describing every course. These were what I think were the ingredients, you know. It was one of those kind of meals. Absolutely magnificent. About a week after that adventure, Tev and I had been invited to dinner with our friend's extended family, which was really lovely. And I was chatting with a woman I just met, and I was saying about this wonderful restaurant we'd been to, and how odd it was that there was no advertising that I could see. She replied simply that it was so famous that it didn't need to be advertised. People in Provence just know about the place, and so they flock there. So, a couple of discoveries made on a holiday. One that was sought out on purpose, a deliberate journey, the trip to the restaurant. And the other bit of an accident, caught us by surprise, discovery of these castles. Okay, today's January 6th, as you know, it's a tradition in the Christian church to celebrate today as Epiphany. Now that word epiphany is defined as a moment when you suddenly feel that you understand something. It's kind of a fresh awareness. And it's usually styled as a type of mystical, spiritual experience. In the church, the particular theological notion of the epiphany is specifically a reference to a manifestation of Jesus Christ to the world, particularly to the Gentiles, to the non-Jewish people. And this is typically told in this rich story of the visit of the Magi that Wanda just shared with us from Matthew's Gospel. While we do kind of sneak the Magi, sometimes called the wise men, that's what it says in my Bible anyway, as we sometimes sneak the Magi into our Christmas stories, we have them hovering just behind the angels in our nativity scenes, or in the case of our sanctuary here, at the other end of the organ from the Holy Family who are on this end. The biblical story seems to suggest that they arrived on the scene a little later. And it could have been days or weeks or months or even possibly years. It's actually not clear in the scriptural account. But odds are the Magi weren't rubbing elbows with the shepherds. And as we've discussed here before, even the exact number of the Magi, who are essentially the scientists of the day, the exact number isn't made explicit in the Bible. It's not stated. But being that there were three gifts presented, three seems like a logical number to me, unless there were four Magi and someone forgot a gift, which would be really embarrassing. Anyway, that's another sermon, and thankfully not one I'm about to preach. What is important, and what I think is interesting, is that they were seeking. The shepherds on that Christmas night, they were just minding their own business, and they got blindsided by the heavenly host. Next thing they knew, they were at the manger, and no one was more surprised to be there than the shepherds. That quiet evening on the hillside, watching their flocks, got turned into something totally unexpected. Now the Magi, on the other hand, they were on a mission. They were on a mission to find something. And we're told that, as scientists often did in that time and place, and I suppose to some extent still do, that they've been searching the sky for understanding of this world. And they somehow discerned that a new Jewish king had been born. So they went out searching to, and I quote, to pay him homage. That's the way my translation puts it. To pay him homage. Now that word homage is a bit of an uncommon one today. We don't usually use it much in our regular conversation, and I encourage you to try it once this week to see if you can work it into conversation with someone. But anyway, if these Magi were from Persia, as some have suggested they were, for them to pay homage meant that they were planning to fall upon their knees and that they would touch the ground with their foreheads as a way of expressing reverence. Now, why seekers of wisdom from so far away will be drawn to a new Jewish king is kind of an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, what drove them to make what was really a very, very dangerous trip? I mean, was it just a search for knowledge, an interest in the truth? Or was something else driving them, something perhaps they couldn't put into words, some kind of yearning? We don't know. But we do know that their journey took them to the palace of the current king of the Jewish people, Herod the Great. How he got the moniker the Great is worthy of examination. He was, in fact, a great builder, by all accounts. But that's, you know, if you look at any study of the historical record, you will discover very quickly that he was paranoid. He was paranoid about any rivals to his throne. And that led him even to have his sons killed off. Hence the expression, better to be Herod's pig than his son. Such was his obsession with maintaining power. So when the Magi arrive asking about a child born king of the Jews, alarm bells went off in Herod's mind. In fact, Matthew records that he was frightened. He also notes that everyone else in Jerusalem was frightened as well, because a worried Herod meant there was a trouble brewing. So Herod does a quick check of his own staff of religious professionals, asked about this hope for Messiah, and they say that Bethlehem is the prophesied birthplace. And this wily king then sends the Magi on with their search, asking them to report back as soon as they find the little tyke, because he'd surely like to pay him a visit too. And he's doubtlessly already putting together a plan to eliminate this young potential rival. You know the rest of the story. The Magi leave. They make their way to Jesus' house. It actually says, not an inn, it actually says a house, which is also an interesting bit of information. They follow the star, of course, and they meet Jesus and Mary, where they kneel before him, and they present the gifts they've brought. The episode concludes with us being told that because of a dream, the Magi didn't go back to Herod, that they discerned that this wouldn't end well. And if we were to keep reading, we'd find out that through another dream, this time to Joseph, the Holy Family would retreat to Egypt to avoid Herod's rage, a rage that would cause the murder of all the male children under the age of two in the vicinity of Bethlehem, which is a very sobering story so soon after Christmas carols. Tevis and I spent a good portion of Friday taking down our interior Christmas decorations. We do a fairly substantial domestic Christmas celebration in our house. We do not believe there's such a thing as Christmas in excess. So it was no small amount of work assembling all the decorations, packing them into totes, hauling them back down to our crawl space, my job, and then putting all our regular stuff back into place, her job. We're pretty organized about our work, but somewhere in the midst of packing, we discovered that we'd misplaced the nativity set, which arrived in our lives about the same time our daughter did, which was 30-some-odd years ago, and hence we are rather attached to this nativity set. In other words, somehow we'd lost Jesus. And that caused us some consternation, and we began searching. Eventually, he turned up behind the ornaments on the table, and how he got there was a bit of a mystery, still don't know. But I was once again reminded how in the busyness of our lives, how easy it is to lose sight, not so much of the baby in the nativity set, but of course, of the adult who calls us to follow him. Now, those of you who were here last week, and there were a good many people here last week on what's usually a low Sunday, attendance-wise. Sorry about the bulletin shortage. But those of you who were here will remember that you were asked to consider a question that seemed to logically arise out of the Bible reading, which was, have you ever found yourself losing Jesus? If you weren't here last week, and I want to know why, but if you weren't here last week, that Bible reading was the one about Jesus' parents losing him in Jerusalem. And, you know, they go back, they find him in the temple. Didn't you know I'd be in my father's house? It's that episode. But, you know, I realize it's truly not that hard, even at Christmas, to lose Jesus. But this week I have a related question. It's not a bad one for the start of a new year. And that's, have you found him? Have you discovered Jesus, not behind a pile of ornaments on the table, but have you encountered him for the first time or become reacquainted with him after some time of absence? It strikes me that there are generally a couple of ways that we make Jesus' acquaintance. You can find him unexpectedly, you know, like the shepherds did, or you can embark on a search, like the Magi. Both possibilities, I'm sure, are present here this morning. I mean, why are you here at church today? Are you surprised to find yourself at church today? Well, it just might be that your life is about to be gloriously turned upside down. To which I say praise be to God, because it's life as it's designed to be lived. Now, you may have seen it on the way in. There's that little sign that says, "Welcome home." It's affixed to that lovely picture by Rembrandt. No, it's not. It's a reproduction, okay? You've got to own up to that. It's not a real Rembrandt. But it's that reproduction of Rembrandt's The Return of the Prodigal. It's in our entranceway. Welcome home, it says. So you may be surprised to be here, but it's no accident. On the other hand, you may be here because this is clearly where you've been led. This is a destination or a way station that's been a deliberate search, part of a deliberate search. What we might call maybe the journey of discipleship. You heard your name called somewhere or another, and you've been following and growing and learning and slowly taking on the resemblance of the one we call Lord. And of course, we're glad you're here too. So why am I talking about this? Because that relationship, that friendship, that followership that comes from finding Jesus powers everything else we do here. It is the foundation on which we build our life. Yeah, it's easy to lose him. But thankfully, he's also not that hard to find. In fact, a trip to this table might be the beginning. Or even the end of that journey of finding Jesus. To which I say thanks be to God. Amen.